We arrive out of many singular rooms, walking over the branching streets. We come to be assured that brothers and sisters surround us to restore their images on our eyes. We enlarge our voices in common speaking and singing. We try again that solitude found in the midst of those who with us seek hidden reckonings. Our eyes reclaim the remembered faces. Their voices stir the surrounding air. The warmth of their hands assures us, and the gladness of our spoken names. This is the reason of cities, of homes, of assemblies in the houses of worship. It is good to be with one another. Bev, would you light our chalice for me? We light our chalice this morning for the power of memory. Let us be mindful of forces deep within that call us to become more than we are. May we be reminded here of our highest aspirations and inspired to bring our gifts of love and service to the altar of humanity. May we know once again that we are not isolated beings, but that we are connected in mystery and miracle to the universe, to this community, and to each other. I invite you to rise in body or in spirit to sing hymn number 145. I believe it will be played through once first. Okay, it's 145 as Tranquil Streams. Going to assist in our first message. She will show you these wonderful illustrations. This is from a book called Wilfred Gordon MacDonald Partridge by Mem Fox, and the illustrations are by Julie Vivas. There once was a small boy called Wilfred Gordon MacDonald Partridge, and what's more, he wasn't very old either. His house was next door to an old people's home, and he knew all the people who lived there. He liked Mrs. Jordan, who played the organ. He listened to Mr. Hosking, who told him scary stories. He played with Mr. Tippett, who was crazy about cricket. He ran errands for Miss Mitchell, who walked with a wooden stick. He admired Mr. Drysdale, who had a voice like a giant. But his favorite person of all was Miss Nancy Allison Delacourt Cooper, because she had four names, just as he did. He called her Miss Nancy, and told her all his secrets. One day, Wilfred Gordon heard his mother and father talking about Miss Nancy. "Poor old thing," said his mother. "Why is she a poor old thing?" asked Wilfred Gordon. "Because she's lost her memory," said his father. "It isn't surprising," said his mother. "After all, she is 96. "What's a memory?" Wilfred Gordon asked. He was always asking questions. "It is something you remember," said his father. But Wilfred Gordon wanted to know more, so he called on Mrs. Jordan, who played the organ. "What's a memory?" he asked. "Something warm, my child, something warm." He called on Mr. Hosking, who told him scary stories. "What is a memory?" he asked. "Something from long ago, me lad, something from long ago." He called on Mr. Tippett, who was crazy about cricket. "What's a memory?" he asked. "Something that makes you cry, my boy, something that makes you cry." He called on Miss Mitchell, who walked with a wooden stick. "What's a memory?" he asked. "Something that makes you laugh, my darling, something that makes you laugh." He called on Mr. Drysdale, who had a voice like a giant. "What's a memory?" he asked. "Something as precious as gold, young man, something as precious as gold." So Wilfred Gordon went home again to look for memories for Miss Nancy, because she had lost her own. He looked for the shoebox of shells he had found long ago last summer, and he put them gently in a basket. He found the puppet on strings, which always made everyone laugh, and he put that in the basket, too. He remembered with sadness the medal which his grandfather had given him, and he placed it gently next to the shells. Next, he found his football, which was as precious as gold. And last of all, on his way to Miss Nancy's, he went into the hen house and took a fresh, warm egg from under a hen. Then Wilfred Gordon called on Miss Nancy and gave her each thing, one by one. "What a dear, strange child to bring me all these wonderful things," thought Miss Nancy. Then she started to remember. She held the warm egg and told Wilfred Gordon about the tiny speckled blue eggs she had once found in a bird's nest in her aunt's garden. She put a shell to her ear and remembered going to the beach by tram long ago and how hot she had felt in her button-up boots. She touched the medal and talked sadly of the big brother she had loved who had gone to the war and never returned. She smiled at the puppet on strings and remembered the one she had shown to her sister and how she had laughed with a mouthful of porridge. She bounced the football to Wilfred Gordon and remembered the day she had met him and all the secrets they had told. And the two of them smiled and smiled because Miss Nancy's memory had been found again by a small boy who wasn't very old either. Now the children are going to class. Shall we sing "Go Now in Peace"?
Go now in peace, go now in peace. May the spirit of love surround you everywhere you may go.
One of the ways in which we stay connected is in sharing the personal joys, concerns, and hopes in worship each week. Let us bring into this circle of caring those unable to be with us, those who are present today, and those who are here only in memory. If you have something to share, please raise your hand and I'll bring you a microphone as Bev lights a candle signifying this community's love and care. You may also light a candle in silence during the offertory music. We hold in the heart of this community those whose candles speak for them, those who are ill or grieving, those whose pain is too great to name, and a world community so in need of healing. We remember those who have served in the military, particularly those who never made it home from battle, and those veterans who have died by their own hand since returning home. In the stillness of a shared silence, let us hold them and each other gently in the strength and comfort of this religious community. On May 2, 1915, during the Second Battle of Ypres, a young Canadian artillery officer, Lieutenant Alexis Helmer, was killed by an exploding German artillery shell. He was serving in the same Canadian artillery unit as a friend of his, the Canadian military doctor and artillery commander, Major John McCrae. As the brigade doctor, John McCrae was asked to conduct the burial service for Alexis because the chaplain had been called away that evening. It is believed that later that evening, after the burial, John began the draft for his now famous poem, In Flanders Field. It is believed that the death of his friend, Alexis, was the inspiration for that poem. In Flanders fields, the poppies blow between the crosses row on row that mark our place. And in the sky, the larks, still bravely singing, fly, scarce heard among the guns below. We are the dead. Short days ago, we lived, felt dawn, saw sunset glow, loved and were loved, and now we lie in Flanders fields. Take up our quarrel with the foe. To you from failing hands we throw the torch. Be yours to hold it high. If ye break faith with us who die, we shall not sleep, though poppies grow in Flanders fields. I invite you to read responsively, reading number 718 with me, please. Did someone say that there would be an end? What has been once so interwoven cannot be raveled, nor the gift ungiven. Mother and child, lover and lover mated, are wound and bound together and in flowing. And memory makes kings and queens of us. We who find shelter in the warmth within, listen and feel new cherished, new forgiven. It is time now in this space, made sacred by our design, to reach deep within our spirit selves. In the stillness of a shared silence, may we be touched by the presence of those who have gone before us. We remember this day those who honored the heritage of their calling to live and to die as people of faith, those who have fought for their country, those who have struggled for justice, those who have served the cause of freedom with passion and compassion. Let us bear witness to their courage and strength by naming aloud those whose memory we wish to keep alive. We remember now the moments shared, the times of celebration and the times of difficulty. We remember now the times of warmth and closeness and the times of love and companionship. Spirit of the living God, may this hour consecrated to the memory of the departed. Remind us to treasure all that was good in their lives, that we may retain that goodness as part of the very fabric of our lives. Let us hold in our hearts all the soldiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and other war-torn places in the world. Let us gather in the strength and courage of our forebears to teach our children and ourselves to live with reverence for life and in harmony with all creation. In the name of the spirit of love that binds us one to the other, may we devote ourselves to tasks that revere the dead in the land of the living. Help us to honor the dead by our actions and our aspirations. May their memory lead us to love one another with all our hearts. Then indeed, the memory of their lives will be for a blessing. Amen. We no longer see the daily photographs of flag-draped caskets that appeared on the front page of many newspapers during the early years of the Iraq War. At the time, the coverage of the war generated a great deal of controversy. Some questioned the appropriateness of so prominently displaying the realities of the most recent war to kill our young people. They didn't want to rub salt in the wounds of the families affected. Unlike wars of yesteryear, our government was seemingly unable to quash the flow of information from war zones to homeland. Technology eliminates the obstructions to providing unfiltered and sometimes unbearable images from war-torn lands. We are the recipients of more information than we can process. For a time, we experienced grief and outrage at these images of war. Now, compared to the atrocities we witness at the hands of ISIS, the old pictures seem almost civilized. And as cities in Iraq and Syria fall, we might wonder if the 36,000 lives sacrificed in that war counted for anything. In 1866, the women in Waterloo, New York, gathered in a labor of love and sorrow to create floral wreaths. The townspeople then carried the wreaths in solemn processions and placed them on the graves of Civil War soldiers, both blue and gray, north and south. The intent of this event, which was called Decoration Day, was to mourn and remember all the soldiers without distinguishing among them. It was an attempt to transcend differences of allegiance and to emphasize the horror and loss of war for everyone. The meaning of Memorial Day has shifted from its original intent of healing and reconciliation. The war dead take a back seat to the families and friends who gather around picnic tables and volleyball nets to celebrate a day off from work and the unofficial beginning of summer. We need to remember the dead in the land of the living. We need to honor their memory by making them a part of our living tradition. According to UU minister Jack Mendelson, our religion does not indulge in self-deceit. It is lived. It is not just a set of bromides and pietisms. It is a serious effort to conduct life according to principles and ideals. It is emotional, heart-swelling. It is even naive. It is firsthand, a personal experience. It is responsible. It is compassionate. It is social, struggling to realize its own vision at community, national and world levels. This is our history and also our hope. The institutional memory of our country has shifted. In wars past, there was an ideal for which soldiers fought. Thanks to our forebears who fought for freedom, we have the right to worship as we choose, the right to elect our government representatives, the right to speak and to assemble, and the right to be secure. Today's war on terror is rooted in security and retaliation. The Patriot Act has allowed our government to compromise our rights as citizens in the name of national security. The memory of the dead becomes just another way to justify violating human rights in the interest of homeland security. As Jimmy Carter framed it, U.S. policies are giving license to abusive governments and reversing decades of progress toward freedom. In the war on terror, soldiers today fight to protect a way of life for people whose rights and opportunities are being denied, often by us, as well as by their own leaders. War itself is not necessarily an honorable enterprise. This excerpt from one of Florence Nightingale's letters during the Crimean War offers her view of war. What the horrors of war are, no one can imagine. They are not wounds and blood and fever spotted and low and dysentery, chronic and acute, and cold and heat and famine. They are intoxication, drunken brutality, demoralization, and disorder on the part of the inferior. Jealousies, meanness, indifference, selfish brutality on the part of the superior. When we honor the dead, we need to remember them as full human beings. Not all soldiers died as heroes. Not all veterans of wars fought honorably. Today we're shocked and horrified by the atrocities broadcast on CNN and over the internet from all sides of the war. Abuses at the Abu Ghraib prison chronicled the realities of war in a way that we've never witnessed firsthand before. In Vietnam, it was My Lai that highlighted the injustices of war. Prior to that, the reported news was filtered through the Office of War Information or the Committee on Public Information. No doubt there were abuses such as Florence Nightingale documented, but what we were taught were the honorable aspects of war. Rebecca Harding Davis, associate editor of the New York Tribune from 1869 to the mid-1870s, wrote these observations about war. There was one curious fact which I do not remember ever to have seen noticed in histories of the war, she wrote, and that was its effect upon the nation as individuals. Men and women thought and did noble and mean things that would have been impossible to them before or after. A man cannot drink old bourbon long and remain in his normal condition. We did not drink bourbon, but blood. No matter how gentle or womanly we might be, we read, we talked, we thought, perforce of nothing but slaughter. So many hundreds dead here, so many thousands there, were our last thoughts at night and the first in the morning. The effect was very like that produced upon a household in which there has been a long illness. We no longer gave our old values to the conditions of life. Our former ideas of right and wrong were shaken to the base. The Ten Commandments, we began to suspect, were too old-fashioned to suit this present emergency. The soldiers who fought bravely came home when disbanded with their pockets full of spoons and jewelry, which they had found in farmhouses looted and burned on Sherman's march to the sea, and they gaily gave them around to their sweethearts as souvenirs of the war. The memory of the soldiers who died are souvenirs enough for any war. They are the dead in the land of the living. We do their deaths a disservice if we fail to remember them as human beings who died doing a job most of us wouldn't take. We need to honor their sacrifices as people of principle. But even as we lift up that memory, we need to put their sacrifices in a context. The ultimate purpose of a war is to win. It is us against them. It's a stance that fosters the kind of atrocities that appall us. In the military, a recruit is trained to steel him or herself against emotions. They are taught to exercise violence and inflict death. Drill sergeants shriek, "Kill, kill, kill," while at the same time using sexual epithets to degrade any soldier whose violence is less than persuasive. On Memorial Day, we honor the sacrifices of dead soldiers. That is a part of tradition. Tradition is the living faith of the dead. But part of our job as people of faith is to ask the question posed by one of my colleagues, Kendall Gibbons. What do the living owe to the dead? What do we owe these brothers and sons, and now sisters and daughters too, all dead, in the name of protecting those of us who go on living? What do we owe them? There is honor in the memory of those who died fighting for principles they hold dear, but there's also sadness and dashed hopes for what their lives might have been had they lived. In the last declared war by our country, soldiers returned home amid the fanfare of parades and celebrations. I cannot imagine being the parent or sibling of a dead soldier when the rest of the country is jubilantly embracing the returning heroes. But I can't imagine being the niece of a dead soldier. My Uncle Frank, who died before I was born, was killed in Germany. He was no hero. In fact, by most accounts, he was always a bit of a loser when it came to finding his way in the world. He left to mourn his death a widowed mother, 5 sisters, my mother was one of them, and his best friend, who was my father. Frankie returned home in a box and was given a military funeral at the church in which he and his sisters had been christened. In his life, Uncle Frank never amounted to much. His death was supposed to bring honor to his family, but his family would rather have had him back alive. And I would like to have known this uncle, who was funny, if a little bit schleppy. He was kind to my mother, and he was loyal to my father. His memory is a family ghost that inhabits our lives and makes war haters of his loved ones. What do the living owe to the dead? We owe them the chance to live their lives through us. We owe them more than honoring their memory one day a year. We need to keep them alive in our hearts and act as if their lives and their deaths had meaning. Their lives need to matter for something beyond the simple act of dying in a war. Like the religion we have inherited that is part of a living tradition, we must make a serious effort to conduct our lives according to principles and ideals. When we're touched by the ultimate sacrifice others have made, we owe them the honor of living our own lives with integrity and commitment. Our lives are forever intertwined with theirs. What has been plaited cannot be unplaited. Only the strands go richer with each loss, and memory makes kings and queens of us. They are with us still, these dead. We, the living, carry them with us. We are their voices, their hands, and their hearts. May we take them with us, and with them choose the deeper path of living. Amen. Our closing hymn is number 318, We Would Be One. The music will play through one verse before we start singing. Please rise in body or in spirit. invite you to remain standing and join hands if you wish as we extinguish the chalice before the benediction. We extinguish this flame, but not the light of truth, the
warm heart of community,
the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. We are the unforgetting dead. Remember us well. We traveled far with the brave in struggle against fascist spoil, and often dig our private grave in hostile foreign soil. We, the unforgetting dead, beg no requiem, nor ruffle of a muted drum, nor fluted column in memoriam. We lived as men the best we could, and our sweaty work is done. Your liberty cost our youthful blood. Freedom is our legacy for all or none. Ideals for which we fought to your children must be taught. You must prove we did not die in vain, so that war shall never come again. We pass this task to you, the living. Do not file our lessons on time's dusty shelves. Remember us, and remembering, save yourselves. Blessed be.